You're listening to Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Bailey, and thank you for faculty for inviting me. It's been a wonderful week. You just embraced me with love and affection, and it's been wonderful. Chaplain Bill made mention that half the faculty had been my students, but there's one person on this faculty who was my teacher and exemplifies 2 Timothy 2 of a faithful teacher. That's Dwight Pentecost. Thank you, Dwight. It's also fitting that I honor those who helped me with the PowerPoint presentation. This is the first time I've ever done it, and probably the last time. Linda Tomchak prepared them, and Jim Hoover and I, along with Linda, edited them because I had mistimed myself so badly. And so we've been up here every morning at 8:30 trying to adjust, and they've just been terrific. Would you join me in expressing appreciation to them? The preamble to Proverbs, we have been arguing, teaches the expositor the code that opens the lock to the gated paradise of Proverbs. In the past two lectures, we learned the first four numbers of the code. Understanding the literary genre, assuring the expositor that God's authority is stamped on its coined and relevant proverbs. Two, understanding its human author, especially Solomon. Challenging the expositor to sympathize with the king's commitment to Israel's covenant and with his wit. Three, understanding its concept of wisdom, namely social skills that produce an abundant life. Four, understanding its intended audiences, originally the royal court, then democratized to Israel's youth, and finally extended in the canon to all the people of God. We now learn the last two numbers of the code, understanding its words, 1:6, and understanding the concept, the fear of I am, 1:7. Understanding its words comes from for attaining wisdom, for understanding words of insight. Well, that's verse 2 in the summary statement. The preamble summary statement of purpose includes for understanding words of insight, 1:2b. In Hebrew, unlike English, word refers to a whole sentence. In this case, to the whole proverb or saying, not an isolated term within them. Verse 6, at the end of the preamble's purpose clauses, expands this introductory summary statement to, for understanding, proverbs and parables, the sayings of the wise and their riddles. Words of insight of the summary, verse 2, are now specified as proverbs, which refers to Solomon's proverbs exclusively, and sayings, which refers to the sayings of others than Solomon. Of the book, if words of insight are now collected as proverbs and its parallel sayings of the book 7 collections. The proverbs and sayings are further specified as parables and riddles. The terms proverbs, parables, and riddles are used together in Habakkuk 2:6 for the same poem, suggesting that the parallel synonyms, parables and riddles, are co-referential terms for the parallel synonyms, proverbs and sayings. The Proverbs of Solomon and the sayings of the wise are parables and riddles because they demand the noetic and existential function to relate the proverb to one's own situation. The book's aphorisms call upon their audience to make an intuitive critical judgment on their own situation. Consider, for example, Agur's numerical saying in chapter 30. The sayings of Agur, son of Jakka, an oracle, and then one of his numerical sayings, four things on earth are small, yet they are extremely wise. Ants are people of little strength, yet they store up their food in the summer. Badgers are people of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. Locusts have no king, yet they advance together in ranks. A lizard can be caught with the hand, yet it is found in kings' palaces. According to the superscript of Agur's inspired sayings in 31, he addresses his sayings to Ithiel, a court official, whom he warns not to exalt himself above his superiors in 30, 32, and 33. Agur is not aiming to teach Ithiel zoology through this numerical parable about weak creatures. Rather, the small animals in his riddle represent a weak and vulnerable official such as Ithiel, and Ithiel represents all God's people. Yet the vulnerable creatures, in Hebrew literal people, to point us to the metaphor, functions as a parable, an illusion on survival. From the weak ant, learn to prepare for the future by making provision ahead of time. A possible illusion is to store up the inspired proverbs and sayings to have them ready on your lips when needed, 22:18, as Jesus did in having the book of the law on his lips to defeat the devil. From the defenseless rock badger, learn to find your protection in the crag of a rock, such as trusting God, who revealed himself in Proverbs, and to trust him with all your heart, 3:5, 22:19. And from the locust, learn not to be a maverick to prevail in community. And yes, wonder of wonders, though nothing more than a lizard, you will live in a royal palace, even the ivory palace of heaven. This interpretation is not allegorical. It is the intention of the parable to be applied in such a way. Whether the riddle-like nature of Proverbs refers as well to rhetorical criticism is uncertain. But the expositor of Proverbs must master the book's rhetoric. Consider the grouping of Proverbs in Collection 2, found in 10:6 through 14. This grouping pertains to communication. Verse 6, then. Blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. The mouth of the wicked in Hebrew is ufi reshaim, overwhelms is yikaseh, and violence is hamas. Verse 7, the name of the righteous is used in blessings, but the name of the wicked will rot. The wise in heart accepts commands, but a chattering, and NIV, literally, lippy. It's the word for lips. It means a lip of fools. But a chattering fool would be a good dynamic equivalent, comes to ruin. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but whoever takes crooked paths will be found out. Literally, whoever winks the eye, which is unlike our winking and flirting, but it means to wink maliciously. Whoever winks maliciously causes grief. And a chattering fool, a lippy fool, comes to ruin. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Now it's the same. Ufi, Meshai, Yikaseh, Hamas. Hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. Wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of the one who lacks sense. The wise store up knowledge, but the mouth of a fool is imminent terror. On the first reading, the collection seems a willy-nilly lumping together of unrelated proverbs. But a knowledge of rhetorical criticism suggests that the demarcated unit falls into two equal halves, each having four proverbs consisting of antithetical parallels. Note the but in verses 6 through 9 and 11 through 14, around a proverb that functions as a janus. Janus is the technical word in rhetorical criticism for a transition. It's the Roman god of doorways, one head, two faces, looking back, looking ahead. It's like the month January from this god. So the janus, you look back, you look ahead. Around a proverb that functions as a janus and pivot, separating the two halves and consisting of a synthetic parallel. Note the and, not but, verse 10. The unit is unified and made more memorable by mentioning two body parts in the first verse of each quatrain, a quatrain being two verses. Note the two body parts in the first verse of the quatrains of the two verses, the two quatrains in verse half. Blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked. Verse 8, the wise in heart accepts commands, but a lippy fool comes to ruin. The pivot also mentions two body parts. Whoever winks the eye causes grief, and a chattering fool comes to ruin. Now note the mentioning of two body parts in the first verses of the quatrains in the second part. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of one who lacks sense. Of these body parts, the focus is on those involved in communication. Note the fourfold mention of the mouth in verse 6, twice in verse 10, verse 14, the threefold mention of the lips, verses 8, 10, and 13, and the reference to the sinister eye, verse 10. In sum, six of the nine verses mention body parts, and of the 11 mentioned body parts, eight refer to organs of communication. The key word, mouth, lip, point to the unit's topic, speech, or more broadly, communication. Thematically, the first half of the unit focuses on the effects of good and bad communication on oneself. Blessings, that means people will pray God's blessings on this person. Blessings crown the head of the righteous. But violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked, that is, it boomerangs and destroys them. Verse 7, the name of the righteous is used in blessing, that is, as one blesses others, they invoke God's blessing that that person will be like the memory of this person. But the name of the wicked will rot. The wise in heart accepts commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but whoever takes crooked paths will be found out. The second half focuses on the effects of good and bad speech on others. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Hatred stirs up dissension, but love covers over all wrongs. Wisdom is found on the lips of the discerning, but a rod is for the back of the one who lacks sense. The synthetic center verse chiastically reverses the pattern, pointing to the pain of communication on others in 10a and its pain to self in 10b. Whoever winks maliciously causes grief to others, and a chattering fool comes to ruin himself. The connection between the pivot and the first half and its unexpected reversal is clearly signaled by repeating verse 8b in 10b. The wise in heart accepts commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin. Whoever winks maliciously, or winks the eye, causes grief, and a chattering fool comes to ruin. In the light of the pivot that divides the focus on the good and bad effects of communication on oneself and on others, other patterns emerge. Mouth occurs in the two verses that introduce the unit's two halves. Blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. Verse 11, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Moreover, both introductions, verses 6 and 11, juxtapose righteous versus wicked. Even more striking is the play in sound and sense in these introductions. But violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked, verse 6b, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence, translate the same Hebrew. Ufi rishayim yikaseh hamas. The chiastic parallelism in verse 6 shows that hamas, violence, is the subject. Yikaseh means cover, and ufi rishayim, mouth of the wicked, is the object. But in verse 11, the chiastic parallelism shows that hamas is violence, that hamas, violence, is the object. Yikaseh now means cover, and mouth of the wicked is the subject. The initial pun both links the two halves and signals that the first pertains to the effects of communication on oneself, verses 6 through 9, and the second on its effects on other. Moreover, mouth, the key word in the semantic domain of communication, frames the unit. Blessings crown the head of the righteous, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked. The wise store of commands, verse knowledge, verse 14, but the mouth of a fool is like a cherry bomb, imminent terror. By the way, this translation will be found only in the TNIV. And that was voted for unanimously by the committee, one of those rare moments. Unless the expositor wears the glasses of rhetorical criticism in connection with reading the Hebrew text, he cannot see clearly its meaning and its message. To coin a proverb, to know what a text means, one must know how it means. Having solved the riddle, the expositor is now in a position to state his big idea. Good communication heals. Bad communication hurts. Of course, there is a pun in the thesis. Good speech heals self and others. And bad speech hurts self and others. From that, the message issues, learn to speak well and heal yourself and your community. Avoid bad speech that destroys your life and burns down the community. Moreover, a sermonic outline can now be developed that faithfully represents the exegetical outline of the text. One, the beneficial and baneful effects of speech on self, verses 6 through 7. A, beneficial effects of good speech. One, people will crown you with blessings during your lifetime. Two, your memory will bring blessings on others for generations. Three, you will walk securely and not be tripped up. Capital B, baneful effects of bad speech. One, your violent speech will boomerang, come back upon you. Two, your memory will rot and stink. Three, you will come to ruin. Note the alternating parallelism between one, crown you, and one prime, come back upon you. Two, memory a blessing, and two prime, memory a stench. Three, walk securely, and three prime, come to ruin. Now the second half. The beneficial and baneful effects of speech on others, verses 11 through 14. A, beneficial effects of good speech on others. Your righteous speech will be a fountain of life. Two, your discerning lips will yield wisdom. And three, your wise speech will be a storehouse of knowledge. Baneful effects of bad speech on others. Sinister speech causes grief. Hateful speech causes quarrels. Foolish speech is like a cherry bomb. You never know when it's going to explode and destroy a community. Conclusion, accept these commands, verse 8a. Live by them constantly, 9a. It is a matter of the heart. Hate versus love, verse 12. In my commentary on Proverbs, pages 47 through 48, I give the expositor the glasses of rhetorical criticism to enable him to read. And I also give the expositor the Hebrew that most of us don't have time to master. And that's why I wrote the commentary. Let us now learn the final number of the code to unlock the door. Number 6, understanding the fear of I am. According to the preamble, the final code number for the expositor to unlock Proverbs is his mastery of the concept, the fear of I am. The preambles to the Egyptian instruction literature contain a code similar to the first five numbers, but this sixth number, understanding the fear of I am, is unique to the Bible. Many call this number the key to the book of Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Beginning means the fundamental, the foundation on which all else is built. It may be likened to the first step of a ladder on which other steps are built, not to a starting block that the runner leaves behind. Elsewhere, the fear of I am is said to be founded on wisdom, not on its co-referential term knowledge as here. Probably the co-referential term knowledge was used in 1:7 to make the pun an inclusio with 1:2, as we noted the Da'at Hakma Umusa. We to know wisdom and instruction, and then the different six syntax. To fear I am is the beginning of knowledge, to know wisdom and destruction fools despise. The expositor can gain mastery of the concept of the fear of I am by 1, noting the expression is a collocation of 2 Hebrew terms. 2, defining the collocation from its uses. And 3, exegeting 2:1-4, which analyzes the psychological, spiritual components that comprise the fear of I am. 1, fear of I am is a collocation. It's a collocation of 2 words, Yirat Adonai, whose combination of words yields a distinct meaning. The formula H2O is not the same as the differentiated 2 parts of hydrogen and 1 part oxygen. Even as one will not understand butterfly by analyzing butter and fly independently, so also fear of I am cannot be understood by studying fear and I am in isolation. 2, uses of fear of I am. From the collocation's uses, it can be adduced that the fear of I am involves both rational and non-rational aspects of the human psyche. On the one hand, fear of I am entails a rational aspect, an involvement with words of an objective revelation that can be taught and memorized. Note Psalm 19, 7-9. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are sure and altogether righteous. In these 4 quatrains, fear of I am is equated with his law, statutes, precepts, commands, and ordinances. On the other hand, the fear of I am also entails a non-rational aspect, an emotional response of fear, love, and trust. The unified psychological poles of fear and love come prominently to the fore in a surprisingly uniform way in Scripture. Deuteronomy treats love of I am and fear of I am as co-referential terms in many texts. The emotional response finds expression in humility, that is to say, a brokenness that obeys I am. Fear of I am and humility are parallel terms in Proverbs 15:32. Wisdom instruction is to fear I am, and humility comes before honor. In 22:4, fear of I am is in opposition to humility. 22:4 reads literally, the wages for humility, the fear of I am sort, is riches, honor, and life. TNIV glosses uniquely the awkward grammar by, humility is the fear of I am. The emotional link connecting God's objective revelation and with the meekness is the fear of I am. The wise humble themselves before God's revelation because they fear and stand in awe of him who holds their lives and their deaths in his hand. For the wise, the fear of I am and love of I am are co-referential terms for their spiritual disposition. Both aspects of their psyche are rooted in their faith. They believe I am is, that he has spoken in the Bible in such a book as Proverbs, that he says what he means and that he means what he says. They believe his promises and love him. They believe his threats and fear him. And some, Charles Bridges says, the fear of the Lord is that affectionate reverence by which the child of God bends himself humbly and carefully to his Father's law. Exegesis of 2:1-5. We now exegete 2:1-5, which analyzes the psychological, spiritual components that comprise the fear of I am. My son, if you accept my commands, store up my words, rather, which are my proverbs and sayings, and store up my commands within you, by making your ear attentive, you will incline your heart to understanding. And if you call out for insight and cry aloud for understanding, if you look for it as for silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of I am and find the knowledge of God. First, then, accepting the catechism. All four verses that comprise the condition for understanding the fear of I am mention the objective revelation that the mind must engage wisdom's expression in its words. The wisdom in view is the seven collections of proverbs. I will refer to their proverbs as sayings by the catechism. Let us now look at the verbs that unpack the psyche of one who fears I am. The first is to accept the catechism, laying the foundation for the heaping up of other terms. To accept entails a faith commitment to the catechism. The philosopher of science, Michael Polanyi, argues that true knowledge flows from personal commitment to a set of particulars as tools or clues to shape a skillful achievement, not from detached observation of them. From a set of clues, a scientist commits himself to a theory that leads to new knowledge. Somewhat analogously, a child knows, discovers, learns, and experiences the skill of riding a bicycle by risking and committing himself or herself to the ride and using skillful actions, not by acquiring facts about a bicycle. One understands the fear of I am and knows God not merely by reading and or hearing the catechism, but by accepting it. That is to say, by entrusting one's life and behavior to the God who stands behind the catechism. This commitment is counterintuitive because it calls upon the catechumen to serve others, not self. In fact, that commitment may involve taking up a cross, that is, to accept death, to serve God and others. B, by memorizing the catechism with religious affection. In the second condition, if you store up my commands within you, commands escalates words, and store ups escalates accept. Store up means to hide or conceal something for a definite purpose. It also implies that one prizes, treasures what is being stored. The metaphor alludes to memorizing with religious affection the catechism. The prologue to the 30 Sayings of the Wise reaffirms the second component of what it means to fear I am, that is to say, to memorize the catechism with religious affection. Its prologue, pay attention, listen to the sayings of the wise, apply your heart to what I teach, For it is pleasing when you keep them in your heart and have all of them ready on your lips. If you want a pure life, this is how to do it. See, by paying attention to the catechism. But memorization is not enough. One must pay attention to what is memorized. Verse 2 breaks the syntax between the conditional clauses of verses 1, 3, and 4, and the consequence of verse 5, and so constitutes an aside. Literally, verse reads, 2 reads, by making your ear attentive to wisdom, you will incline your heart to understanding. The aside contains its own condition and consequences, for it implies, if you pay attention to the wisdom taught in these sayings, you will incline your heart to understanding, that is piety and ethics. To make the ear attentive is a vivid way of saying to pay attention. Simone Weil and others argue that moral improvement does not come about by the exercise of the will. Moral change, she says, comes from an attention to the world whose natural result is a decrease in egoism through an increased sense of the reality of someone or something, end of quote. Again, quote, change of behavior, metanoia, is not brought about by straining and willpower, but by a long, deep process of unselfing, end of quote. The psychological process inclines the heart, a metaphor meaning to win over the heart. When a student has an increased sense of the reality to the increase of the reality of attention to the catechism, the truth of the catechism wins over the heart from self-absorption to experiencing the fear of I am. D, by passionate desire for the truths of the catechism. The fourth component in this heaping up of parallel terms to hear stereophonically what it means to fear I am is to desire the catechism passionately. Indeed, if you call out for insight, cry aloud for understanding. Cry aloud glosses a Hebrew term that refers to a fervent and emotional situation, such as when Joseph wept so loudly in his own chambers, Pharaoh's whole household heard him. Finally, earnestly study the catechism. The fifth component achieves the desired extension of the conceptual range of what is meant by the fear of I am. If you seek for it as for silver, search for it as for hidden treasure. To seek has in view to search for something lost or missed. And when that something is silver and crown jewels, the desire to fulfill the wish or realize the plan has an extreme emotional nuance. It means to strive after something, be busy, be concerned. The metaphor also may imply that a great deal of effort and sacrifice must be expected to get it. Quote, though it costs all you have, get understanding. 4:7. Conclusion. In conclusion, the Christian expositor recognizes that the initial condition leading to the fear of I am to accept is God's good gift. Every good and perfect gift, including faith, comes from God. In other words, the expositor depends upon God's grace to empower his preaching. Moreover, the Christian expositor takes note of the progress of revelation. In the Old Testament, God encountered his people in the catechism of these seven collections. They're memorizing it with religion affection. They're de-selfing themselves and they're paying attention to it. And their passionate yearning and willingness to make sacrifices to realize its truth. In the New Testament, God encounters his people in his own person, in his Son. The fear of I am for the church now entails their engaging these spiritual psychological processes with reference to Jesus Christ and his teachings. His teachings extend those of the catechism to their fullest range Now righteousness is seen to entail dying for sinners as he had. In Christ's resurrection, the abundant life promised in Proverbs reaches its full conceptual range. Jesus Christ brought the full light of day, and the expositor preaches the book in the zenith of the day. Thank you.